Vitelli's was on Ganzevoort in the heart of the meatpacking district. Large black trucks crowded the curb at odd angles, and the faint smell of soured blood rose from the cobblestones. In some infernal version of Noah's Ark, teamsters walked off the trucks onto the loading docks, carrying carcasses of different species slung over their shoulders, two by two. Two calves, two pigs, two lambs. Butchers on break dressed in blood-spattered aprons smoked in the cold December air under the great steer-shaped neon sign that Hank had stylized in his painting. They watched me navigate the cobblestones in high-heel shoes with the same indifference that they watched the meat coming off the trucks. A hophead in a woman's coat was nodding on the stoop. His nose and chin were scabbed as if he'd broken a fall with his face. After a little prodding, he said that Hank lived in number 7, saving me the social studies lesson of rapping on every door. The stairway was narrow and damp. Halfway up the first flight was an old Negro with a cane who could have ascended faster to heaven than he could to the fourth floor. I passed him and climbed to the second landing. The door was ajar. Given all that had happened, I'd prepared myself to find Tinker at low ebb. Hell, at one point, I'd even hoped to find him that way. But standing there on the banks of his comeuppance, I wasn't so sure I was ready for it. "Hello?" I ventured, easing the apartment door open. The word apartment hardly applied. Lucky number 7 was 200 square feet. It had a squat iron bed with a gray mattress, the sort you'd expect to see in a prison cell or barracks. In the corner, a coal stove sat by a small, but thank God for it, window. But for a few pairs of shoes and an empty gunny sack stowed under the bed, Hank's belongings were gone. Tinker's were on the floor against the wall. A leather suitcase, a flannel blanket tied in a roll, a small stack of books.
"He ain't in there."
I turned to find the old Negro on the landing beside me.
"If you looking for Mr. Henry's brother, he ain't in there."
The old Negro pointed his cane toward the ceiling.
"He on the roof."
On the roof. The very place where Hank had built the bonfire of his canvases, before he turned his back on New York City and his brother's way of life. I found Tinker sitting on a dormant chimney, his arms resting on his knees, his gaze cast downward to the Hudson River, where the cold gray freighters were lined along the docks. From the back, he looked as if his life had just set sail on one. "Hey," I said, stopping a few paces behind him. At the sound of my voice, he turned and stood, and I could see in an instant that I was wrong again. Dressed in a black sweater, clean-shaven and easy, Tinker wasn't close to downcast.
"Katie,"
he said in pleasant surprise. Instinctively, he took a step forward, but then stopped as if he'd caught himself, as if he suspected that he'd forfeited the right to the friendly embrace, which in a way he had. His smile took on an aspect of knowing contrition, signaling that he was ready to receive, or even welcome, another round of reprobation. "They killed Wallace," I said, as if I'd just heard the news and couldn't quite believe it.
"I know,"
he said. And then I unraveled, and his arms were around me. We ended up spending an hour or two on the roof, sitting on the edge of a skylight. For a while, we just talked about Wallace, and then we were quiet. And then I apologized for how I had acted in the coffee shop, but Tinker shook his head. He said I'd been terrific that day, that I hadn't missed a trick, that it was just what he had needed. As we sat there, dusk was falling, and the lights of the city were coming on one by one in ways that even Edison hadn't imagined. They came on across the great patchwork of office buildings and along the cables of the bridges. Then it was the street lamps and the theater marquees, the headlights of the cars and the beacons perched atop the radio towers. each individual lumen testifying to some unhesitant, intemperate collective aspiration.
Hank would spend hours on end up here, Tinker said. I used to try to get him to move, to take an apartment in the village with a sink, but he wouldn't budge. He said the village was too bourgeois, but I think he stayed because of the view. It's the same one we grew up with.
A freight horn blew, and Tinker pointed to it, as if it proved his point. I smiled and nodded.
I guess I haven't told you much about my life in Fall River, he said.
No.
How does that happen? How do you stop telling people where you're from?
By inches. Tinker nodded and looked back over the piers.
The irony is that I loved that part of my life, when we lived near the shipyards. It was a ragtag neighborhood, and when school let out, we'd all run down to the docks. We didn't know the batting averages, but we knew Morse code and the flags of the big shipping lines, and we'd watch the crews coming down the gangplanks with their duffels over their shoulders. That's what we all wanted to be when we grew up. Merchant marines. We wanted to set sail on a freighter and make landfall in Amsterdam or Hong Kong or Peru.
You look back with the benefit of age upon the dreams of most children, and what makes them seem so endearing is their unattainability. This one wanted to be a pirate, this one a princess, this one president. But from the way Tinker talked, you got the sense that his starry-eyed dreams were still within his reach, maybe closer than ever. When it grew dark, we retreated to Hank's room. In the staircase, Tinker asked if I wanted to get a bite. I said I wasn't hungry, and he looked relieved. I think we'd both had our fill of restaurants for the year. Without any chairs on hand, we made do sitting face to face on two overturned produce crates, Hallelujah onions and Aviator limes.
How are things going at the magazine? He asked enthusiastically.
Up in the Adirondacks, I had told him about Allie and Mason Tate and the search for our first cover story. So now I told him my idea of interviewing the doorman and some of the scuttle we'd dredged up. As I was describing it, for the first time I felt a little squeamish. Somehow the whole notion seemed more unseemly here in Hank's flophouse than it had in the back of Mason Tate's limousine. But Tinker loved it. Not in the way that Mason loved it, not because it was going to peel the New York potato. Tinker just loved the ingenuity of it, the human comedy of it, that all those secrets of adultery and illegitimacy and ill-gotten gains, secrets which had been so closely kept, had all the time been floating freely across the surface of the city unheeded, just like the little boats that boys fold from the headlines and sail across the ponds in Central Park. But most of all, Tinker loved that I had come up with the idea.
We deserve it, he said with a laugh and a shake of the head, classing himself among the secret keepers.
You certainly do. When we both stopped laughing, I began telling him some funny story we'd learned from an elevator boy. But he cut me off.
I encouraged her, Katie.
I met his gaze.
From the minute I met Anne, I encouraged her to take me on. I knew exactly what she could do for me, and what it would cost.
That wasn't the worst of it, Tinker.
I know. I know. I should have told you at the coffee shop, or upstate. I should have told you everything the night we met.
At some point, Tinker noticed that my arms were wrapped around my torso.
You're freezing, he said. I'm such an idiot.
He leapt up and looked around the room. He unfurled his blanket and put it over my shoulders.
I'll be right back.
I heard him trounce down the stairs. The door to the street slammed shut. With the blanket still on my shoulders, I stamped my feet and wandered in a circle. Hank's painting of the protest on the pier was lying on the center of the gray mattress, suggesting that Tinker had been sleeping on the floor. I stopped in front of Tinker's suitcase. The inside of the lid was lined with blue silk pockets, sized for different items, a hairbrush, a shaving brush, a comb, all of which presumably had borne Tinker's initials, and all of which were gone. I knelt to look at the stack of books. They were the reference books from the study at the Beresford, and the Book of Washingtonia that had been given to him by his mother. But there was also the edition of Walden that I had seen in the Adirondacks. It was a little more scuffed around the edges now, as if it had been carried in a back pocket, up and down the trail to Pinion Peak, up and down 10th Avenue, up and down this narrow flophouse stair. Tinker's footsteps sounded on the landing. I sat on his crate. He came through the door with 2 pounds of coal wrapped in newspaper. He got down on his knees in front of the stove and set about lighting the fire, blowing on the flames like a scout. He always looked his best, I thought to myself, when circumstances called for him to be a boy and a man at the same time. That night, Tinker borrowed a blanket from a neighbor and laid out 2 beds on the floor, a few feet apart, maintaining the same respectful distance that he had established on the roof when I'd first arrived. I rose early enough so I could get home and shower before work. When I got back in the evening, he leapt up from the Hallelujah Onions as if he'd been waiting there all day. Then we went across 10th Avenue to the little diner on the piers with a blue neon sign that read, "Open All Night." It's a funny thing about that meal. All these years later, I remember the oysters I ate at the 21 Club. I remember the black bean soup with sherry at the Beresford when Eve and Tinker had returned from Palm Beach. I remember the salad I had with Wallace at the park with the blue cheese and bacon. And all too well, I remember the truffle-stuffed chicken at La Belle Epoque. But I don't remember what we ate that night at Hank's Diner. What I remember is that we had a lot of laughs. Then, at some point, for some stupid reason, I asked him what he was going to do. And he grew serious.
"Mostly," he said, "I've been thinking about what I'm not going to do. When I think of the last few years, I've been hounded by regrets for what's already happened and fears for what might, by nostalgia for what I've lost and desire for what I don't have. All this wanting and not wanting, it's worn me out. For once, I'm going to try the present on for size."
"You're going to let your affairs be as 2 or 3, and not 100 or 1,000?
"That's it," he said. "Any interest?"
"What'll it cost me?"
"According to Thoreau, nearly everything."
"It'd be nice to have everything at least once before giving it up." He smiled.
"I'll give you a call when you've got it."
When we got back to Hank's apartment, Tinker lit a fire and we swapped stories into the night, the details of one circumstance triggering the memory of another and then another in effortless succession. Like two teenagers who've struck up a friendship on a cross-Atlantic steamer, we raced to trade reminiscences and insights and dreams before reaching port. And when he laid out our bedrolls at the same respectful distance, this time I pushed mine over until there wasn't a breath of space between us. The next evening, when I returned to Ganzevoort Street, he was already gone. He hadn't taken the fine leather case. It was sitting there empty beside the stack of books, its lid leaning against the wall. In the end, he had stuffed his clothes into his brother's gunny sack. I was surprised at first that he'd left the books behind, but on closer inspection, I saw that he'd taken the little worn edition of Walden. The stove was cold. On top of it, there was a note in Tinker's hand, written on a torn end paper. "Dearest Kate, you have no idea what it has meant to me to see you these last 2 nights. To have left without speaking, without telling you the truth, would have been the only regret I carried away. I'm so glad that your life is going well. Having made a hash of mine, I know what a fine thing it is to have found your spot. It was a rotten year of my own making. But even at its worst, you always gave me a glimpse of what might otherwise be. I'm not sure where I'm going,
he concluded. But wherever I end up, I'll start every day by saying your name. As if by doing so, he might remain more true to himself. Then he signed it. Tinker Gray, 1910 to... ? I didn't linger. I went down the stairs and into the street. I got as far as 8th Avenue before turning back. I trudged all the way across Ganzevoort, back over the cobblestones, up the narrow stair. And when I got into the room, I grabbed the painting of the dock workers, along with the volume of Washingtonia. One day he would regret having left them behind. I looked forward to being in a position to return them. Some of you will think this a romantic thing to have done. But at another level, the reason I went back for Tinker's things was to assuage a sense of guilt. For when I had walked in the room and found it empty, even as I was fending off a sense of loss, a slender, vigorous part of myself was feeling a sense of relief. Chapter 26. A Ghost of Christmas Past. On Friday, the 23rd of December, I was sitting at my kitchen table cutting slices from a 10-pound ham and drinking bourbon from a bottle. Beside my plate was a proof of the premier issue of Gotham. Mason had spent a lot of time thinking about the cover. He wanted it to be eye-catching, beautiful, witty, scandalous, and above all else, a surprise. So only three copies of the mock-up existed: Mason's, the art director's, and mine. It was a photograph of a naked woman standing behind a 5-foot-high model of the San Remo apartment building. Through the windows, you could see her skin, but curtains had been drawn selectively to obscure your view of her finer parts. I had been given one of the mock-ups because the image had been my idea. Well, sort of. It was actually a variation on a painting by René Magritte that I had seen at the Modern. Mason had loved the idea and bet me my career that I couldn't find a woman to pose for it. The photograph was framed so that you couldn't see the woman's face. But if the curtains on the 15th floor had been open, you would have seen a pair of eggplant-colored silver dollar Orioles. That afternoon, Mason had called me into his office and asked me to sit, something he hadn't done more than twice since the day he'd hired me. As it turned out, Allie had been on the money with her plan. Both of us were going to be held on for another year. When I stood to go, Mason gave me his congratulations, the proof with the mock-up, and as a bonus, he threw in the honey-baked ham that the mayor had sent him. I knew it came from the mayor because his honor's warm wishes were written on a golden card in the shape of a star. Lugging the ham under my arm, at the door I turned back to thank Mr. Tate. "No thanks are necessary," he replied without looking up from his work. "You've earned it." "Then thank you for giving me the opportunity in the first place."
"You should thank your sponsor for that."
"I'll give Mr. Parrish a call." Mason looked up from his desk and eyed me with curiosity.
"You'd better keep a closer eye on who your friends are, Content. It wasn't Parrish who recommended you. It was Anne Grandin. She's the one who twisted my arm."
I took another slug of bourbon. I wasn't much of a bourbon drinker, but I had bought the bottle on the way home thinking it would go well with the ham. And it did. I had bought a little Christmas tree, too, and set it up by the window. Without decorations, it looked a little forlorn, so I pulled the mayor's golden star off the ham and propped it on the highest branch. Then I got myself comfortable and opened Hercule Poirot's Christmas, Mrs. Christie's latest. I had bought it back in November and had been saving it for tonight. But before I could get started, there was a knock at the door. I suppose it's an immutable law of human nature that we sum up the events of the year as we approach its end. Among other things, 1938 had been a year of knockings at my door. There was the Western Union boy who brought Eve's birthday wishes all the way from London,
and Wallace with a bottle of wine and the rules of honeymoon bridge, then Detective Tilson, then Bryce, then Anne. In the moment, only some of those intrusions seemed welcome, but I guess I should have treasured them all, because in a few years' time, I'd be living in a doorman building myself. And once you're in a doorman building, no one comes knocking ever again. Tonight, the knocker at my door was a heavy-set young man dressed in a Herbert Hoover suit. The walk up the stairs had winded him, and his brow looked waxy with perspiration.
Miss Content?
Yes?
Miss Catherine Content?
That's right. He was greatly relieved.
My name is Niles Copperthwaite. I'm an attorney with Heavily and Hound.
You're kidding, I said with a laugh. He looked taken aback.
Hardly, Miss Content.
I see. Well, an attorney making house calls on the Friday before Christmas. I hope I'm not in some sort of trouble.
No, Miss Content, you're not in any trouble.
He said this with all the confidence of youth, but a moment later he added,
at least no trouble of which Heavily and Hound is aware.
A well-considered qualification, Mr. Copperthwaite. I shall bear it in mind. How can I help you?
You have helped me already by being at home at your previously listed address. I come at the behest of a client.
He reached behind the door jamb and produced a long object wrapped in heavy white paper. It was tied with a polka dot ribbon and had a tag that read, Don't open till Xmas.
This is being delivered, he said. As per the instruction of
one Wallace Wolcott.
That's right.
He hesitated.
It's a little out of the ordinary as
Mr. Wolcott is no longer with us. We were both silent.
If you don't mind my saying so, Miss Content, I can see that you are surprised. I hope the surprise is not an unpleasant one.
Mr. Copperthwaite, if there were mistletoe over my door, I would kiss you.
Well, yes. I mean, no.
He stole a glance at the top of the door frame, then straightened his posture and said more formally,
A Merry Christmas to you, Miss Content.
And a Merry Christmas to you, Mr. Copperthwaite. I was never the type to wait until Christmas morning to open gifts. If I've got a Christmas present in my grips on the 4th of July, I'll open it by the light of the fireworks. So I sat down in my easy chair and opened this package that had been waiting so patiently to come knocking at my door. It was a rifle. I didn't know it then, but it was a Winchester 1894 from a small run overseen by John Moses Browning himself. It had a walnut stock, an ivory sight, and elaborate floral scrolling on the polished brass frame. It was a rifle you could have worn to your wedding. Wallace Wolcott sure had the gift of timing. You had to grant him that. I balanced the rifle in my palms the way that Wallace had taught me. It probably weighed no more than 4 pounds. I pulled back the action and looked inside the empty chamber. I closed it again and leveled the gun against my shoulder. Sighting down the barrel, I aimed at the top of my little Christmas tree, and then I shot the mare's star right off the top. December 30th. 20 minutes before the whistle, the foreman circled by and told them to slow the fuck down. In a long chain, teams of two were relaying sacks of sugar from a Caribbean freighter to a warehouse on the Hell's Kitchen wharf. He and the Negro they called King were at the front of the chain, so when the foreman gave the order, King reset the tempo. 1 1,000 hook, 2 1,000 heft, 3 1,000 turn, 4 1,000 toss. On the day after Christmas, the Union of Tugboat Engineers had gone on strike without warning or the support of the longshoremen. At the edge of the lower bay, somewhere off Sandy Hook and Breezy Point, an armada of cargo ships were drifting, waiting to make landfall. So the word up and down the line was to ease it. God willing, the strike would be over before the ships in dock were empty, and they'd be able to keep the crews intact. As the new man, well he knew that if they began cutting, he'd be the first to go. But that was just as it should be. The pace that King had chosen was a good one. It let him feel the strength in his arms and his legs and his back. The strength was moving through him now, with every swing of the hook, like an electrical charge. It was a feeling that he had lived without for a long time, like the feeling of hunger before supper, or exhaustion before sleep. Another good thing about the pace was that it allowed for a little more conversation. 1/1000 hook.
So where are you from, King?
Harlem.
2/1000 heft.
How long have you lived there?
All my life.
3/1000 turn. How long have you worked this wharf?
Even longer.
4/1000 toss. What's it like?
Just like heaven, full of fine folk who mind their own business.
He smiled at King and hooked the next sack, because he understood what King was driving at. It was the same in Fall River. Nobody liked the new guy to begin with. For every man the company hired, there were 20 brothers or uncles or childhood pals who'd been passed over. So the less trouble you made for yourself, the better. And that meant carrying your weight and keeping your mouth shut. When the whistle sounded, King lingered as the other men headed for the 10th Avenue bars. He lingered too. He offered King a cigarette, and they smoked with their backs against a packing crate, watching the men retreat. They smoked idly, without speaking. When they were done with their cigarettes, they tossed the butts off the pier and began walking toward the gates. Halfway between the freighter and the warehouse, there was a pile of sugar on the ground. One of the men must have torn the burlap of a sack with his hook. King paused over the sugar and shook his head. Then he knelt, took a fistful, and put it in his pocket.
"Come on," he said. "You might as well take some, too. If you don't, it's just going to the rats."
So he knelt down and took some, too. It was amber and crystalline. He almost put it in his right pocket, but remembered in time that the right pocket was the one with the hole, so he put it in his left. When they got to the gate, he asked King if he wanted to walk a bit. King gestured with his head in the general direction of the elevated. He was headed home to a wife and kids. King had never said as much, but he didn't need to. You could just tell. The day before, when work let out, he had walked south along the wharf, so today he walked north. With nightfall, the air had grown bitter cold, and he wished that he had worn his sweater under his coat. The piers above 40th Street reached into the deepest waters of the Hudson and were lined with the largest ships. Bound for Argentina, the one at Pier 75 looked like a fortress, impregnable and gray. He had heard that it was looking for seafaring men, and he might have angled for the job if he had only saved enough money. He was hoping to wander a bit once he'd made port, but there would be other chances on other boats, heading to other places. On Pier 77, there was a Cunard ocean liner stocked for a transatlantic crossing. On Boxing Day, it was blowing its horn and the confetti was falling from the upper decks to the docks, when word of the strike reached the helm. Cunard sent the passengers home, advising them to leave their trunks on board, as the strike was sure to be resolved within the day. 5 days later, every stateroom had its share of cocktail dresses and evening gowns, of waistcoats and cummerbunds, waiting in a ghostly silence, like the costumes in the attics of an opera house. On Pier 80, the longest pier on the Hudson, there were no ships in dock. It jutted out into the river, like the first leg of a new highway. He walked all the way out to the end. He took another cigarette from the pack and lit it with his lighter. Snapping the lighter shut, he turned and leaned against a piling. From the end of the pier, he could see the city's skyline in its entirety, the whole staggered assembly of townhouses and warehouses and skyscrapers stretching from Washington Heights to the Battery. Nearly every light in every window in every building seemed to be shimmering and tenuous, as if powered by the animal spirits within, by the arguments and endeavors, the whims and elisions. But here and there, scattered across the mosaic, were also the isolated windows that seemed to burn a little brighter and more constant, the windows lit by those few who acted with poise and purpose. He scuffed out his cigarette and decided to dwell in the cold a little while longer. For however inhospitable the wind, from this vantage point, Manhattan was simply so improbable, so wonderful, so obviously full of promise, that you wanted to approach it for the rest of your life without ever quite arriving. Epilogue. Few are chosen. It was the last night of 1940, and the snow was blowing 2 knots shy of a blizzard. Within the hour, there wouldn't be a car moving in all Manhattan. They'd be buried like boulders under the snow. But for now, they crawled along with the weary determination of wayward pioneers. 8 of us had stumbled out of a dance at the university club that we hadn't been invited to in the first place. The party had been on the second floor, under the great palazzo ceilings. A 30-piece orchestra, dressed in white, was ushering in 1941 in the brand-new and already outmoded style of Guy Lombardo. Unbeknownst to us, the party had an ulterior motive, to raise money for refugees from Estonia. When a latter-day Carrie Nation stood alongside a dispossessed ambassador to rattle her tin can, we made for the door. On the way out, Bitsy had somehow come into possession of a trumpet, and as she was making a pretty impressive show of the scales, the rest of us huddled under a street lamp to plan a course of action. A quick look at the roads, and we could tell a taxi wouldn't be coming to the rescue. Carter Hill said he knew of a perfect hideaway just around the corner where we could find food and drink. So under his direction, we set off westward through the snow. None of the girls were dressed for the weather, but I had the good fortune of being tucked under one wing of Harrison Harcourt's fur-collared coat. Midway down the block, a rival party coming in the other direction pelted us with snowballs. Bitsy sounded the charge, and we counterattacked. Taking cover behind a newsstand and a mailbox, we drove them off, hooting like Indians. But when Jack mistakenly toppled Bitsy into a snowbank, the girls turned on the boys. It was as if our New Year's resolution was to act like we were 10. The thing of it is, 1939 may have brought the beginning of the war in Europe, but in America, it brought the end of the Depression. While they were annexing and appeasing, we were stoking the steel plants, reassembling the assembly lines, and readying ourselves to meet a worldwide demand for arms and ammunition. In December 1940, with France already fallen and the Luftwaffe bombarding London, back in America, Irving Berlin was observing how the treetops glistened and children listened to hear those sleigh bells in the snow. That's how far away we were from the Second World War. Carter's nearby hideaway ended up being a 10-block slog. As we turned onto Broadway, the wind howled down from Harlem, blowing the snow against our backs. I had Harry's coat cloaked over my head and was letting myself be steered by an elbow. So when we got to the front of the restaurant, I didn't even see what it looked like. Harry ushered me down the steps, pulled back his coat, and voila! I was in a sizable mid-block joint serving Italian food, Italian wine, and Italian jazz, whatever that was. Midnight had come and gone, so the floor was covered with confetti. Most of the revelers who had spent the countdown in the restaurant had come and gone, too. We didn't wait for their plates to be cleared. We just stomped our shoes, shook off the snow, and commandeered a table for 8 opposite the bar. I sat next to Bitsy. Carter slipped into the chair on my right, leaving Harry to find a seat across the table. Jack picked up a wine bottle left by the prior patrons and squinted to see if there were remnants. "We need wine," he said. "Indeed we do," said Carter,
catching a waiter's eye.
Maestro, 3 bottles of Chianti.
The waiter, who had the big eyebrows and big hands of Bela Lugosi, opened the bottles with glum attention.
Not exactly the jovial sort, Carter observed.
But it was hard to tell. Like so many Italians in New York in 1940, maybe his normal joviality was overshadowed by the unfortunate allegiances of the old country. Carter volunteered to order a few plates for the table and then made a reasonable stab at launching a conversation by asking people what was the best thing they did in 1940. It made me a little nostalgic for Dickie. No one could get a table talking nonsense like Dickie Vanderweil. As someone rattled on about a trip to Cuba, the new Riviera, Carter leaned toward me and whispered in my ear,
"What's the worst thing you did in 1940?
A piece of bread sailed across the table and hit him on the head.
"Hey," Carter said, looking up.
The only way you could tell it was Harry was by his perfect repose and a slight upward turn of his lips. I considered giving him a wink. Instead, I threw the bread back. He acted aghast. I was about to do the same when a waiter handed me a piece of folded paper. It was an unsigned note, scrawled in a rough hand. Should old acquaintance be forgot? When I looked confused, the waiter pointed toward the bar. Seated on one of the stools was a stocky, good-looking soldier. He was grinning a little impolitely. Well-groomed as he was, I almost didn't recognize him. But sure as the shore, it was unwavering Henry Gray. Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Sometimes it sure seems that's what life intends. After all, it's basically like a centrifuge that spins every few years, casting proximate bodies in disparate directions. And when the spinning stops, almost before we can catch our breath, life crowds us with a calendar of new concerns. Even if we wanted to retrace our steps and rekindle our old acquaintances, how could we possibly find the time? The year 1938 had been one in which 4 people of great color and character had held welcome sway over my life. And here it was, December 31st, 1940, and I hadn't seen a single one of them in over a year. Dickie was forcibly uprooted in January 1939. On the heels of the New York cotillion season, Mr. Vanderweil finally became fed up with his son's easy ways. So, under the auspices of the recovering economy, he sent Dickie to Texas to work on an old friend's oil rigs. Mr. Vanderweil was convinced that this would make quite an impression on Dickie, and it did, though not in the way Mr. Vanderweil expected. His friend happened to have an ornery daughter who adopted Dickie as a dance partner when she was home for the Easter break. When she went back to school, Dickie sought to extract some promise of love, only to be rebuffed. While the weeks with Dickie had been great fun, she explained, in the long run she saw herself with someone a little more practical, down to earth, ambitious. That is, of course, someone a little more like her pa. Before long, Dickie found himself working extra hours and applying to Harvard Business School. He would get his degree in 1941, just 6 months before Pearl Harbor. From there he enlisted, served with distinction in the Pacific, returned to marry his Texan, had 3 children, went to work in the State Department, and generally made a hash of everything that anyone had ever said of him. Eve Ross, she just waltzed away. The first I heard tell of her after she disappeared to Los Angeles was a clipping that Peaches gave me in March of 1939. It was a photograph from a gossip magazine, and it showed a boisterous Olivia de Havilland pushing through a line of photographers outside the Tropicana on Sunset. She was on the arm of a young woman with a good figure, a sleeveless dress, and a scar on her cheek. The photograph was titled Gone with the Wind, and the caption referred to the scarred woman as de Havilland's confidant. The next I heard of Evie was on the 1st of April, when I received a long-distance call at 2 in the morning.
The man on the other end of the line identified himself as a detective with the Los Angeles Police Department. He said he was sorry for disturbing me. He knew it was late, but he had no alternative. A young woman had been discovered unconscious on the lawn of the Beverly Hills Hotel, and my telephone number had been found in her pocket. I was stunned. Then I heard Eve in the background.
"Did she bite?"
"Of course she did," said the detective, betraying an English accent. "Like a trout to a fly."
"Give me that."
"Wait." The two were wrestling for the phone.
"April Fools,"
the man shouted. Then the receiver was plucked away.
"Did we get you, sis?"
"Did you ever?" Evie howled with laughter. It was good to hear. For half an hour, we back and forth, bringing each other up to date and paying tribute to the fine times we'd had in New York City. But when I asked if she might be coming back east any time soon, she said as far as she was concerned, the Rockies weren't high enough. Wallace, of course, was stolen from the living. But in one of life's little ironies, of the four with whom I'd spent 1938, it was Wallace who maintained the greatest influence on my daily life. For in the spring of 1939, I received a second visit from the perspiring Niles Copperthwaite. This time, he brought the extraordinary news that Wallace Wolcott had written me into his will. Specifically, he had directed that the dividends from a generation-skipping trust be diverted to me for the remainder of my life. This was to bring me an annual income of $800. $800 may not have been a fortune, not even in 1939, but it was enough to ensure that I could think twice before accepting the advances of any man, which, come to think of it, for a girl in Manhattan entering her late 20s, was fortune enough. And Tinker Gray? I didn't know where Tinker was, but in a sense I knew what had become of him. Having cut himself adrift, Tinker had finally found his way to unfettered terrain. Whether trekking the snows of the Yukon or sailing the seas of Polynesia, Tinker was where the view to the horizon was unimpeded, the crickets commanded the stillness, the present was paramount, and there was absolutely no need for the rules of civility. Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? If so, then only at our peril. I crossed to the bar.
"Katie, right?"
"Hello, Hank. You look well." And he did, better than anyone in their right mind would have expected. The demands of army life had filled out his features and his build, and the stripes on his crisp khaki uniform advertised the rank of sergeant. I acknowledged his stripes with a figurative tip of the hat.
"Don't bother," he said with an easy smile. "They won't last."
But I wasn't so sure. He looked like the army had yet to see the best of him. He nodded toward our table.
"I see you found yourself a new circle of friends."
"Several."
"I'll bet." "I think I owe you one. Let me buy you a drink."
He ordered beer for himself and a martini for me, as if he'd known all along that that was my drink. We clinked glasses and wished each other a happy 1941.
"Have you seen my brother around?"
"No," I admitted. "I haven't seen him in 2 years."
"Yeah, I suppose that makes some sense."
"Have you heard from him?"
"On and off. When I get leave, sometimes I come up to New York and we get together."
I wasn't expecting that. I took a drink of my gin. He eyed me with a sly smile.
"You're surprised,"
he said. "I didn't know that he was in New York."
"Where would he be?"
"I don't know. I just figured that when he quit, he'd left town."
"No, he stuck around. He got a job working on the Hell's Kitchen docks for a while. After that, he drifted around the boroughs, and we lost touch. Then last spring, I ran into him on the street in Red Hook."
"Where was he living?" I asked.
"I'm not sure. One of the flop houses by the Navy Yards, I suppose."
We were both silent for a moment. "How was he?" I asked.
You know, a little scruffy, a little lean.
No. I mean, how was he?
Oh, Hank said with a smile. You mean, how was he on the inside?
Hank didn't need to consider.
He was happy.
The snows of the Yukon, the seas of Polynesia, the footpaths of the Mohicans. These were the sorts of terrain that I had imagined Tinker wandering for the last 2 years. And all the time, he had been right here in New York City. Why had I assumed that Tinker was so far afield? I'd like to say it was because the unsettled landscapes of London and Stevenson and Cooper had suited his romantic sensibility since he was a boy. But as soon as Hank said that Tinker was in New York, I knew that I had pictured him far afield, because it was easier for me to accept his willingness to leave if it was to travel alone in the wilds. So it was with mixed feelings that I received this news. Picturing Tinker wandering among the crowds of Manhattan, poor in all but spirit, I felt regret and envy, but a touch of pride, too, and a little bit of hope. For wasn't it just a matter of time before we crossed each other's path? Despite all the hoopla, wasn't Manhattan just 10 miles long and a mile or two wide? So in the days that followed, I kept an eye out. I looked for his figure on the street corners and in the coffee shops. I imagined coming home and having him emerge once more from the doorway across the street. But as the weeks turned into months, and the months into years, this sense of anticipation waned, and slowly but surely, I stopped expecting to see him in a crowd. Swept along by the currents of my own ambitions and commitments, my daily life laid the groundwork for the grace of forgetting. Until, that is, I finally ran into him after all, in the Museum of Modern Art, in 1966. Val and I took a taxi back to our apartment on Fifth Avenue. The cook had left us a little dinner on the stove, so we warmed it and opened a Bordeaux and ate standing in the kitchen. I suppose that for most, the image of a husband and wife eating reheated food at their counter at 9 o'clock would lack a certain romance. But for Valentine and me, who dined out formally so often, eating alone on our feet in our own kitchen was the highlight of the week. As Val rinsed the plates, I walked down the hallway toward our bedroom. Along the wall were photographs hung from floor to ceiling. Normally, I ignored them as I passed, but on this night, I found myself considering them, one by one. Unlike the photographs on Wallace's walls, these were not from 4 generations. They were all from the last 20 years. The earliest was of Val and me at a black tie affair in 1947, looking a little awkward. A mutual acquaintance had just tried to introduce us, but Val had cut him short, explaining that we had already met, on Long Island, in 1938, when he had given me a ride into the city to the tune of Autumn in New York. Among the photographs of friends and of vacations in Paris and Venice and London, were a few with a professional bent. There was the cover of the February 1955 issue of Gotham, the first that I was to edit, and there was a picture of Val shaking the hand of a president. But my favorite was the picture of the two of us at our wedding, with our arms around old Mr. Hollingsworth, his wife already gone, and he soon to follow. Having poured the last of the wine, Val found me in the hall, surveying the photographs.
"Something tells me you're going to stay up a little longer," he said, handing me my glass. "Do you want company?"
"No, you go ahead. I won't be long." With a wink and a smile, he tapped a picture taken on the beach in Southampton shortly after I had cut my hair 1 inch too short. Then he gave me a kiss and went into the bedroom. I went back to the living room and out onto the terrace. The air was cool, and the lights of the city shimmered. The little planes no longer circled the Empire State Building.
but it was still a view that practically conjugated hope. I have hoped. I am hoping. I will hope. I lit a cigarette, and then I threw the match over my shoulder for good luck, thinking, doesn't New York just turn you inside out? It is a bit of a cliché to characterize life as a rambling journey on which we can alter our course at any given time. By the slightest turn of the wheel, the wisdom goes, we influence the chain of events and thus recast our destiny with new cohorts, circumstances, and discoveries. But for the most of us, life is nothing like that. Instead, we have a few brief periods when we are offered a handful of discrete options. Do I take this job or that job? In Chicago or New York? Do I join this circle of friends or that one? And with whom do I go home at the end of the night? And does one make time for children now? Or later still? In that sense, life is less like a journey than it is a game of honeymoon bridge. In our 20s, when there is still so much time ahead of us, time that seems ample for 100 indecisions, for 100 visions and revisions, we draw a card, and we must decide right then and there whether to keep that card and discard the next, or discard the first card and keep the second. And before we know it, the deck has been played out, and the decisions we have just made will shape our lives for decades to come. Maybe that sounds bleaker than I intended. Life doesn't have to provide you any options at all. It can easily define your course from the outset and keep you in check through all manner of rough and subtle mechanics. To have even 1 year when you're presented with choices that can alter your circumstances, your character, your course, that's by the grace of God alone, and it shouldn't come without a price. I love Val. I love my job and my New York. I have no doubt that they were the right choices for me. And at the same time, I know that right choices, by definition, are the means by which life crystallizes loss. Back in December 1938, alone in that little room on Ganzevoort Street, having already cast my lot with Mason Tate and the Upper East Side, I stood beside Tinker's empty suitcase and his cold coal stove, and I read his promise to start every day by saying my name. For a while, I guess I had done the same. I had started the days saying his. And just as he had imagined, it had helped me maintain some sense of direction, some sort of unerring course over seas tempest-tossed. But like so much else, that habit had been elbowed aside by life, becoming first intermittent, then rare, then lost to time. Standing on my balcony overlooking Central Park almost 30 years later, I didn't punish myself for having let the practice lapse. I knew too well the nature of life's distractions and enticements, how the piecemeal progress of our hopes and ambitions commands our undivided attention, reshaping the ethereal into the tangible, and commitments into compromises. No, I wasn't too hard on myself for all those years that had passed without my saying Tinker's name. But on the following morning, I woke with it on my lips, and so I have on so many mornings since. Appendix. The Young George Washington's Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior in Company and Conversation. First, every action done in company ought to be with some sign of respect to those that are present. Second, when in company, put not your hands to any part of the body not usually discovered. Third, show nothing to your friend that may affright him. Fourth, in the presence of others, sing not to yourself with a humming noise, nor drum with your fingers or feet. Fifth, if you cough, sneeze, sigh, or yawn, do it not loud, but privately. And speak not in your yawning, but put your handkerchief or hand before your face and turn aside. Sixth, sleep not when others speak, sit not when others stand, speak not when you should hold your peace, walk not on when others stop. Seventh, put not off your clothes in the presence of others, nor go out your chamber half-dressed. Eighth, at play and at fire, it's good manners to give place to the last comer, and affect not to speak louder than ordinary. Ninth, spit not in the fire, nor stoop low before it, neither put your hands into the flames to warm them, nor set your feet upon the fire, especially if there be meat before it. Tenth, when you sit down, keep your feet firm and even, without putting one on the other or crossing them. 11th, shift not yourself in the sight of others, nor gnaw your nails. 12th, shake not the head, feet, or legs, roll not the eyes, lift not one eyebrow higher than the other, wry not the mouth, and bedew no man's face with your spittle by approaching too near him when you speak. 13th, kill no vermin as fleas, lice, ticks, etc., in the sight of others. If you see any filth or thick spittle, put your foot dexterously upon it. If it be upon the clothes of your companions, put it off privately. And if it be upon your own clothes, return thanks to him who puts it off. 14th. Turn not your back to others, especially in speaking. Jog not the table or desk on which another reads or writes. Lean not upon anyone. 15th. Keep your nails clean and short. Also your hands and teeth clean, yet without showing any great concern for them. 16th. Do not puff up the cheeks, loll not out the tongue, rub the hands or beard, thrust out the lips or bite them, or keep the lips too open or too close. 17th. Be no flatterer, neither play with any that delights not to be played withal. 18th. Read no letters, books, or papers in company, but when there is a necessity for doing of it, you must ask leave. Come not near the books or writings of another so as to read them unless desired, or give your opinion of them unasked. Also, look not nigh when another is writing a letter. 19th. Let your countenance be pleasant, but in serious matters, somewhat grave. 20th. The gestures of the body must be suited to the discourse you are upon. 21st. Reproach none for the infirmities of nature, nor delight to put them that have in mind thereof. 22nd. Show not yourself glad at the misfortune of another, though he were your enemy. 23rd. When you see a crime punished, you may be inwardly pleased, but always show pity to the suffering offender. 24th. Do not laugh too loud or too much at any public spectacle. 25th. Superfluous compliments and all affectation of ceremony are to be avoided, yet where due, they are not to be neglected. 26th. In pulling off your hat to persons of distinction, as noblemen, justices, churchmen, etc., make a reverence, bowing more or less according to the custom of the better bred and quality of the person. Amongst your equals, expect not always that they should begin with you first, but to pull off the hat when there is no need is affectation. In the manner of saluting and resaluting in words, keep to the most usual custom. 27. 'Tis ill manners to bid one more eminent than yourself be covered, as well as not to do it to whom it's due. Likewise, he that makes too much haste to put on his hat does not well, yet he ought to put it on at the first, or at the most the second time of being asked. Now what is herein spoken, of qualification in behavior in saluting, ought also to be observed in taking of place, and sitting down for ceremonies without bounds is troublesome. 28. If anyone come to speak to you while you are sitting, stand up, though he be your inferior, and when you present seats, let it be to everyone according to his degree. 29. When you meet with one of greater quality than yourself, stop and retire, especially if it be at a door or any straight place, to give way for him to pass. 30. In walking, the highest place in most countries seems to be on the right hand, therefore place yourself on the left of him whom you desire to honor. But if three walk together, the middest place is the most honorable. The wall is usually given to the most worthy if two walk together. 31. If any one far surpasses others, either in age, estate, or merit, yet would give place to a meaner than himself in his own lodging or elsewhere, the one ought not to accept it. So he, on the other part, should not use much earnestness, nor offer it above once or twice. 32. To one that is your equal, or not much inferior, you are to give the chief place in your lodging, and he to whom 'tis offered ought at the first to refuse it, but at the second to accept, though not without acknowledging his own unworthiness. 33. They that are in dignity or in office have in all places precedency, but whilst they are young, they ought to respect those that are their equals in birth or other qualities, though they have no public charge. 34. It is good manners to prefer them to whom we speak before ourselves, especially if they be above us, with whom in no sort we ought to begin. 35. Let your discourse with men of business be short and comprehensive. 36. Artificers and persons of low degree ought not to use many ceremonies to lords or others of high degree, but respect and highly honor them, and those of high degree ought to treat them with affability and courtesy, without arrogancy. 37. In speaking to men of quality, do not lean nor look them full in the face, nor approach too near them, at least keep a full pace from them. 38. In visiting the sick, do not presently play the physician if you be not knowing therein. 39. In writing or speaking, give to every person his due title according to his degree and the custom of the place. 40. Strive not with your superiors in argument, but always submit your judgment to others with modesty. 41. Undertake not to teach your equal in the art himself professes. It savors of arrogancy. 42. Let thy ceremonies in courtesy be proper to the dignity of his place with whom thou conversest, for it is absurd to act the same with a clown and a prince. 43. Do not express joy before one sick or in pain, for that contrary passion will aggravate his misery. 44. When a man does all he can, though it succeeds not well, blame not him that did it. 45. Being to advise or reprehend anyone, consider whether it ought to be in public or in private, presently or at some other time, in what terms to do it, and in reproving, show no sign of choler, but do it with all sweetness and mildness. 46. Take all admonitions thankfully in what time or place soever given. But afterwards, not being culpable, take a time and place convenient to let him know it that gave them. 47. Mock not, nor jest at anything of importance. Break no jest that are sharp biting. And if you deliver anything witty and pleasant, abstain from laughing there at yourself. 48. Wherein you reprove another, be unblameable yourself. For example is more prevalent than precepts. 49. Use no reproachful language against anyone, neither curse nor revile. 50. Be not hasty to believe flying reports to the disparagement of any. 51st. Wear not your clothes foul, unripped, or dusty, but see they be brushed once every day at least, and take heed that you approach not to any uncleanness. 52nd. In your apparel be modest, and endeavor to accommodate nature, rather than to procure admiration, keep to the fashion of your equals, such as are civil and orderly, with respect to times and places. 53rd. Run not in the streets, neither go too slowly, nor with mouth open, go not shaking your arms, kick not the earth with your feet, go not upon the toes, nor in a dancing fashion. 54th. Play not the peacock, looking everywhere about you, to see if you be well decked, if your shoes fit well, if your stockings sit neatly, and clothes handsomely. 55th. Eat not in the streets, nor in the house, out of season. 56th. Associate yourself with men of good quality, if you esteem your own reputation, for 'tis better to be alone than in bad company. 57th. In walking up and down in a house, only with one in company, if he be greater than yourself. At the first give him the right hand, and stop not till he does, and be not the first that turns. And when you do turn, let it be with your face towards him. If he be a man of great quality, walk not with him, cheek by jowl, but somewhat behind him, but yet in such a manner that he may easily speak to you. 58. Let your conversation be without malice or envy, for 'tis a sign of a tractable and commendable nature, and in all causes of passion admit reason to govern. 59. Never express anything unbecoming, nor act against the rules moral before your inferiors. 60. Be not immodest in urging your friends to discover a secret. 61. Utter not base and frivolous things amongst grave and learned men, nor very difficult questions or subjects among the ignorant, or things hard to be believed. Stuff not your discourse with sentences amongst your betters, nor equals. 62. Speak not of doleful things in a time of mirth or at the table. Speak not of melancholy things as death and wounds, and if others mention them, change, if you can, the discourse. Tell not your dreams, but to your intimate friend. 63. A man ought not to value himself of his achievements or rare qualities of wit, much less of his riches, virtue, or kindred. 64. Break not a jest where none take pleasure in mirth. Laugh not aloud, nor at all without occasion. Deride no man's misfortune, though there seem to be some cause. 65. Speak not injurious words, neither in jest nor earnest. Scoff at none, although they give occasion. 66. Be not forward, but friendly and courteous. The first to salute, hear, and answer, and be not pensive when it's a time to converse. 67. Detract not from others, neither be excessive in commanding. 68. Go not thither where you know not whether you shall be welcome or not. Give not advice without being asked, and when desired, do it briefly. 69. If two contend together, take not the part of either unconstrained, and be not obstinate in your own opinion. In things indifferent, be of the major side. 70. Reprehend not the imperfections of others, for that belongs to parents, masters, and superiors. 71. Gaze not on the marks or blemishes of others, and ask not how they came. What you may speak in secret to your friend, deliver not before others. 72. Speak not in an unknown tongue in company, but in your own language, and that as those of quality do, and not as the vulgar. Sublime matters treat seriously. 73. Think before you speak. Pronounce not imperfectly, nor bring out your words too hastily, but orderly and distinctly. 74th. When another speaks, be attentive yourself, and disturb not the audience. If any hesitate in his words, help him not, nor prompt him without desired, interrupt him not, nor answer him till his speech be ended. 75th. In the midst of discourse, ask not of what one treateth, but if you perceive any stop because of your coming, you may well entreat him gently to proceed. If a person of quality comes in while you're conversing, it's handsome to repeat what was said before. 76th. While you are talking, point not with your finger at him of whom you discourse, nor approach too near him to whom you talk, especially to his face. 77th. Treat with men at fit times about business, and whisper not in the company of others. 78th. Make no comparisons, and if any of the company be commended for any brave act of virtue, commend not another for the same. 79th. Be not apt to relate news if you know not the truth thereof. In discoursing of things you have heard, name not your author, always a secret discover not. 80th. Be not tedious in discourse or in reading, unless you find the company pleased therewith. 81st. Be not curious to know the affairs of others, neither approach those that speak in private. 82nd. Undertake not what you cannot perform, but be careful to keep your promise. 83rd. When you deliver a matter, do it without passion and with discretion, however mean the person be you do it to. 84th. When your superiors talk to anybody, hearken not, neither speak nor laugh. 85th. In company of these of higher quality than yourself, speak not till you are asked a question, then stand upright, put off your hat, and answer in few words. 86th. In disputes, be not so desirous to overcome as not to give liberty to each one to deliver his opinion, and submit to the judgment of the major part, especially if they are judges of the dispute. 87th. Let thy carriage be such as becomes a man, grave, settled, and attentive to that which is spoken. Contradict not at every turn what others say. 88th. Be not tedious in discourse, make not many digressions, nor repeat often the same manner of discourse. 89th. Speak not evil of the absent, for it is unjust. 90th. Being set at meat, scratch not, neither spit, cough, or blow your nose, except there's a necessity for it. 91st. Make no show of taking great delight in your victuals. Feed not with greediness. Cut your bread with a knife. Lean not on the table, neither find fault with what you eat. 92nd. Take no salt, or cut bread with your knife greasy. 93rd. Entertaining anyone at the table, it is decent to present him with meat. Undertake not to help others undesired by the master. 94th. If you soak bread in the sauce, let it be no more than what you put in your mouth at a time, and blow not your broth at table, but stay till cools of itself. 95th. Put not your meat to your mouth with your knife in your hand, neither spit forth the stones of any fruit pie upon a dish, nor cast anything under the table. 96th. It is unbecoming to stoop much to one's meat. Keep your fingers clean, and when foul, wipe them on a corner of your table napkin. 97th. Put not another bite into your mouth till the former be swallowed. Let not your morsels be too big for the jowls. 98th. Drink not nor talk with your mouth full, neither gaze about you while you are a-drinking. 99th. Drink not too leisurely, nor yet too hastily. Before and after drinking, wipe your lips. Breathe not then or ever with too great a noise, for it is uncivil. 100. Cleanse not your teeth with the tablecloth, napkin, fork, or knife, but if others do it, let it be done with a pick tooth. 101. Rinse not your mouth in the presence of others. 102. It is out of use to call upon the company often to eat, nor need you drink to others every time you drink. 103. In company of your betters, be not longer in eating than they are. Lay not your arm, but only your hand, upon the table. 104. It belongs to the chiefest in company to unfold his napkin and fall to meat first. But he ought then to begin in time and to dispatch with dexterity, that the slowest may have time allowed him. 105. Be not angry at table whatever happens, and if you have reason to be so, show it not but on a cheerful countenance, especially if there be strangers, for good humor makes one dish of meat a feast. 106. Set not yourself at the upper of the table, but if it be your due, or that the master of the house will have it so, contend not, lest you should trouble the company. 107. If others talk at table, be attentive, but talk not with meat in your mouth. 108. When you speak of God or his attributes, let it be seriously and with reverence. Honor and obey your natural parents, although they be poor. 109. Let your recreations be manful, not sinful. 110. Labor to keep alive in your breast that little spark of celestial fire called conscience. Finis. This is Rebecca Lohman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Rules of Civility by Amor Towles. This program was directed by Jessica Kay. Executive producers, Patty Peruz and Janet Stark. Published by arrangement with Viking, a member of Penguin Group, USA, Inc. Text copyright 2011, Cetology, Inc. Production copyright 2011 by Penguin Audio, a division of Penguin Group, USA, Inc., and Books on Tape. All rights reserved.